This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. 60 years ago, Secretary of State George Marshall briefly outlined his ideas for what Europe required in the wake of World War II. On June 5, 1947, he spoke at a commencement ceremony at Harvard University. Marshall's service as Secretary of State followed his service as Army Chief of Staff, a position he held beginning in 1939. At the end of the war, Winston Churchill called him the organizer of victory. This is how Greg Berman begins to tell the story of the Marshall Plan in his new book, The Most Noble Adventure, The Marshall Plan and the Time When America Helped Save Europe. Berman writes that at Harvard, Marshall delivered his remarks in a soft, almost inaudible voice. The American news media paid the speech little or no attention. Today, of course, the Marshall Plan is seen by many as the greatest act of American foreign policy. In this portion of the program, we're going to take a look at the Marshall Plan and its significance for Europe and the U.S. Greg Berman is our guest. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Greg Berman is the Henry Kissinger Fellow for Foreign Policy at the Aspen Institute. In addition to The Most Noble Adventure, The Marshall Plan, and The Time When America Helped Save Europe, he is the author of The Invisible People, How the U.S. Has Slept Through the Global AIDS Pandemic, the Greatest Humanitarian Catastrophe of all time. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Greg Berman, welcome back to the Afternoon Magazine.
Great to be back with you, Celeste.
Nice to talk with you. I thought this was really interesting. Here is this powerhouse of a man, George Marshall, in a soft, almost inaudible voice, speaking before this group of folks at Harvard University. And he's a man who some, including Churchill, credit with the Allied victory in Europe. He was viewed as a military genius. Truman said of him after choosing him for Secretary of State, "The more I see and talk to him, the more certain I am he's the great one of the age." Tell us a little bit about George Marshall. Prior to his becoming Secretary of State, what were some of his greatest accomplishments?
Marshall was a military man. His military career spanned about 45 years. And as you said, he was appointed, rose up through the ranks and was noticed by superiors constantly as an incredible rising talent, and was championed by some of America's leading military figures of the 20th century. During World War I, Blackjack Pershing, General Pershing, the head of the American forces, noticed him and became almost a father figure to him. And when Marshall's wife passed away, Pershing stood in as his best man in his second marriage. And through Pershing's recommendation, Franklin Roosevelt did something unprecedented in military history. He reached behind 34 senior generals and brigadier generals to appoint Marshall as Army Chief of Staff. And the day that happened was September 1, 1939. It's a pretty amazing day to be appointed as Army Chief of Staff. It was the same day that Germany invaded Poland. And so Marshall was Chief of Staff for 6 years before, during, and through the conclusion of World War II. When he became Chief of Staff, the American military ranked about 19th, somewhere near Bulgaria. Marshall led the construction of the modern American military. He had responsibility for military grand strategy in each of the theaters of war. Eisenhower, Patton, MacArthur, these storied commanders in World War II, they reported to Marshall. And Eisenhower, in fact, was a protege of Marshall. And Ike once said, he said, "I wouldn't trade 50 Douglas MacArthurs for one George Marshall." Mm. And then he said, on second thought, that would be a rotten trade. What would you do with 50 Douglas MacArthurs? Mm. And And he was, you know, he was really the most revered man of his, the most revered American of his time, and in my view, probably since. And Truman had the great sense in January of 1947 to summon Marshall from retirement for the second time, because Truman had already asked him to go and mediate the Chinese Civil War, to come to Washington to serve as his Secretary of State. And it was, perhaps in my judgment, the you know, the best decision of Truman's presidency.
Yeah. Soldier to diplomat.
Yeah.
And also, he would go on to win the Nobel Peace Prize.
He was the only professional soldier ever to win the Nobel Peace Prize.
That his acceptance speech is available online. It's very interesting. It's a little over 1 minute in length.
Yeah.
And he is a very soft-spoken man. And what he did was he thanked the American people for what they had done and for their generosity. And now, in your book, though, at the end of the book, The Most Noble Adventure, after that acceptance speech, there was a dinner where he spoke at some length about his reflections on the recent past. Would you kind of give us an idea of what he said? Because I think it sums up nicely what the Marshall Plan was about.
It was. Well, General Marshall, in a way, that speech, it was the last time that Marshall would travel across the Atlantic to Europe, a place where he was tremendously popular after having launched the Marshall Plan, been the figurehead behind it. And it was he was very sick, he was very ill, and it was in some ways his last testament, his last major speech in the world, and he was really a giant of that time. And Marshall said that he believed that the Marshall Plan was important because it addressed the conditions upon which radicalism, totalitarianism, fed. It was not aimed against any one power as such or any one ideology as such, but dealt with a security threat, a military threat, by improving, ameliorating the conditions upon which that threat was feeding. And he said that the lessons of the 30s and what they learned again in the 40s was that where there was poverty, in the words of his Harvard speech, where there was poverty, desperation, and chaos, there will be dictators, there will be totalitarian forces, there will be people who will try to take advantage and exploit people's vulnerability. The wise thing for America to do, as we did in the time of the Marshall Plan, is to help build countries up. And America can be that partner to do that. And it's not only humanitarian, but it's often the best means we have of advancing our security and economic interests and our strategic position. And then he goes on further in really eloquent language to say how important it is to dwell on history and the lessons of history so that we can avoid the mistakes of the past. And those words speak to us in a poignant way and partly a haunting way, I think, because unfortunately we fail to heed a lot of the lessons of the Marshall Plan in our post-war occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan and in our broader foreign policy, I think, at the moment.
At the moment, speaking of at the moment, would it be possible for a Marshall Plan today for Iraq?
Well, I think that the Marshall Plan was unique to its time. Excuse me. Was unique to its time and place, and we sometimes can get into trouble if we try to overlay something that may have worked in a certain historic context onto our own current moment. But having said that, I do think that there were insights and principles and methods of approach that were particularly effective and sound, which do have far-reaching applicability to the challenges and opportunities of our own time. For example, I do think that a really ambitious, stirring program to promote economic opportunity, so it wouldn't be recovery or reconstruction as was with the Marshall Plan, but to promote economic opportunity and partnership in the broader Middle East would redound to great strategic benefit for us right now. I think it would help to strengthen the forces of moderation by providing an alternative vision, one of hope and opportunity and dignity. It would ameliorate the conditions upon which terrorism and radicalism and anti-Americanism thrive. And at, unfortunately, what is a low point for American standing around the world and our moral credibility, and because of that standing, we've seen the strategic fallout from what that means. At this time in which America is at a low, it would help to recast our standing around the world and in the region as a partner in peace and opportunity, and as a country that is responsive to the needs and aspirations of people in that region and around the world.
Hmm. To what extent was the Marshall Plan a cooperative venture with Europe?
It was based on cooperation, a spirit of cooperation and partnership, so much so that when Marshall gave his famous speech at Harvard in June of 47, he made it clear that America did not want to impose a solution on Europe. He said that it would not be, in his words, it would not be fitting for America to impose unilaterally, fitting or efficacious for America to impose unilaterally a program to promote European recovery. That, he said, is the business of the Europeans. And so he extended an invitation to Europe to come together, which was quite an audacious enterprise in and of itself. These were 16 countries in Europe, not a natural grouping. Some had actually been at war a few years before in World War II, asking them to come together to come up with a program for economic recovery. And he said if they did that, America would then stand with its European partners in their own recovery and provide friendly aid. We would help to underwrite the enterprise, providing funding and technical assistance and other forms of assistance, and we would work with them hand in hand to devise the most innovative policies. But it was always clear that self-help was the governing principle, and Marshall planners said that this was Europe's recovery. They gave credit to the Europeans. America simply was a partner in this process.
That idea of self-help and hand-in-hand partnership, is that one of the big lessons of the Marshall Plan for us today?
It really is. It's a big lesson. I think it's an important lesson in development, where, you know, unfortunately, much of our foreign aid has not been effective. I think because it's we're imposing solutions or we're working with foreign large foreign NGOs, and in the process we may be very well meaning, and we may be doing some good work, but self-help, the Marshall Plan teaches us is ultimately what's important. Solutions coming from the countries that are affected, harnessing local capacity, and also the tone, this sense of humility and the spirit of cooperation with which we approached the Marshall Plan served us so well in our foreign policy at that time and in our standing around the world. And I think that that lesson applies to foreign policy more broadly. The importance of cooperation, humility in terms of how we speak, heeding the interests and the needs of our partners around the world.
Very interesting. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Greg Berman, our guest today. His latest book, The Most Noble Adventure, The Marshall Plan, and the Time When America Helped Save Europe. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. We look forward to your questions. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. We have a listener awaiting to talk with you, Greg Berman, on line four from Kentland, Indiana. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hi, Celeste. Thanks for taking my call. Very interesting show. Quick comment, a question, and I'll go ahead and ring off. As mentioned, I think the beauty of the Marshall Plan really saved the markets of the United States by building up Europe. In other words, if we didn't do this for all our products, goods, and services, you know, what would we do with them? We needed to salvage those economies by doing that. And also, this is a little bit far afield, so please excuse me if I'm historically wrong on this, but am I right to assume that near the end of his career, George Marshall's office was somehow brought into the Joseph McCarthy hearings of the 50s? Am I right on that, or am I completely off base? I'll go ahead and listen off air. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Thanks. Two great questions, caller. Thank you very much. Well, it's a great pleasure to talk about Paul Hoffman with your audience, Celeste, because Paul Hoffman was from Chicago, and he was an Illinois, a native son, and he was appointed a Republican by Harry Truman, the Democratic administration, to run the Marshall Plan, to actually execute the program once it was passed in Congress. And Hoffman, in his later years, lamented the fact that most Americans still thought of the Marshall Plan as some sort of charity. And he and his colleagues and the Marshall Planners, they were always very clear that this was not a charity. It was not fundamentally an altruistic enterprise. It was a program in America's strategic interests. And they were clear it was in America's security interests and its economic interests. And that second part was important. America needed Europe as a viable economic partner, as an export market. It came out of World War II with its production roaring, and it needed places to sell its goods, and it needed Europe to work. So economics was part of it, and people were very concerned, of course, about the idea of sending over vast sums of taxpayer dollars over to Europe. They remembered very well the Great Depression of the 1930s, and they were afraid that sort of thing would happen again. So there was a lot of concern, and a lot of it was very fair. But in fact, what happened is that as the caller suggested, we did help to build Europe up, a prosperous, integrated Europe, and America benefited very handsomely from that economically, and America's economy boomed through this time. So that's another interesting lesson. The second question was
about McCarthy.
Yeah, and the caller's absolutely right. McCarthyism rose around this time, particularly after the Korean War broke out in June of 1950, and America had, quote-unquote, lost China. Most historians question whether it was America's to lose in the first place, but China had turned communist, and Stalin was finding great gain in Asia, where he had been having a very difficult time in Europe, in the European theater, because of the Marshall Plan, the Berlin Airlift, NATO, and other American achievements, and and also because of the political dynamics, because the Democrats had held the White House for so long, and of course Dewey lost to Truman in a great upset in '48. So the political temperature is rising, and Soviets seem on the move. And McCarthy comes into place in McCarthyism, and in fact, McCarthy took on George Marshall. He said that Marshall was, tacitly colluding with these communist appeasers, and he called him a traitor. And even McCarthy's staunchest allies said that when you took on Marshall, and Marshall was sort of the George Washington of the figure, that he went way too far. And it actually does. McCarthy gave one of the more particularly poisonous, absurd speeches in Congress, condemning George Marshall, and it actually, does signify the beginning of the end for McCarthy, and even supporters began turning on him around that time. But it was very difficult for Marshall, and Marshall would never answer these charges. He said that if after 45 years, he didn't say this, but he said he had served for 45 years. He had come out of retirement three times to serve his country. All he wanted to do was to go home and live on his farm in Virginia. And he wouldn't answer these questions. He said, if I have to answer charges about being a traitor at this point, it's hardly worth the energy to answer them. But it was a difficult time for Marshall, and I think it was so great that later, after McCarthyism died down, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, and he is rightly recognized in history as one of the greatest Americans.
Let's take another call. A listener waiting to talk with us in Chicago on line 4. Hi.
Are there any George Marshalls in the current horizon that you can speak to about, But really, I wondered about the difference between our economic status after the Second World War. That we were not a debtor nation as we are now. We were a sovereign country economically, even with the aid we were expending in Europe and other places. And we went from that to escalate our nuclear programs and other military industrial complex issues. to the point where we have now seen our economy becoming dissipated, as someone has just written in a book, The Squandering of America. And others have pointed out going along this path with the cost of the war and so forth going into the trillions, with, who knows any way or means to pay for that. How can another economic Marshall Plan even surface since there's so many issues that are being neglected in our issue? So that's a mouthful there. Just thought I'd call in on those points and if you could comment on them.
Thank you. Well, you know, I think there are probably better people than me to comment more broadly on our economic status and the picture of our economy and some of those things that you point out. I do think that, you know, our economy remains very strong, and we have it's important that we retain these foreign commitments and that we're very engaged and that we do harness economic power to advance our security and our national interest. And one of the interesting things about the idea of a new bold program for economic opportunity in the Middle East is that you know, there are so many things that we can do that are not would not require heavy amounts of foreign aid or dollars. We can attract private capital and investment to the region. We can promote favorable trade arrangements. We can use innovative approaches like microfinance and microlending. Can provide vast technical assistance, and all of these things are not dollar centric, but they're invaluable services and invaluable provisions of human capital and intellectual capital in order to promote alternative industries and employment and the sort of things that the region really needs because economics. And so I think there's great opportunity there and ways in which we can do this in a very economic fashion, which make it particularly exciting. And, of course, we stand to gain so much, I think, strategically from that sort of bold initiative. And are there any George Marshalls out there? Well, I think we're waiting for our next George Marshall. He was he had an unusual biography. He lived in unusual times in which we were challenged in the Depression and World War II, and again in that very difficult post-war time. But I think we have our own incredibly steep challenges, and the world has changed in terms of the threats we face and the response required, and I think if another George Marshall emerged, we'd be very lucky.
Hmm. Speaking of human capital and intellectual capital, we've talked a little bit about Marshall and Hoffman. Maybe we can talk also about some of the other key architects in more detail as we go along, but maybe you'd give us some sense of who was recruited to implement the Marshall Plan overall.
Well, one of the reasons why the plan worked is because Harry Truman summoned, and later Paul Hoffman as the person who ran the program, they summoned the best, the most outstanding Americans, the most capable Americans, to be a part of the program. In terms of the real architects, Truman deserves a lot of credit. There was, of course, Marshall, and then Averill Harriman was one of the world's most respected financiers and diplomats. And he was brought on as America's diplomat for the Marshall Plan in Europe in those years. He was extremely effective. And someone named Will Clayton was the intellectual architect, the economic architect behind the plan's design. And Will Clayton was a great American success story. He was born in Tupelo, Mississippi, and he left Tupelo with an eighth grade education, and he became the leading cotton merchant in America. And a multimillionaire, and he was one of those, what they called back then, a dollar-a-year men, people who left very lucrative positions in the private sector and who came on board to government to help in the war effort in those years, and they declined salary, so they were called a dollar-a-year men. And Clayton, you know, had done business in Europe extensively. He knew Europe, and he knew its economic patterns, and he could foresee the problems ahead, and so his insights were instrumental in shaping the plan. There was a senator, a Republican senator named Arthur Vandenberg, who was the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and the Republicans controlled Congress. And with a Democratic administration, not a particularly popular president, it was very clear that in order for the plan to pass Congress, it would need bipartisan support. And Arthur Vandenberg was an ambitious politician, But he announced after Marshall's speech that, in fact, he would not seek the presidency. It was a lifelong ambition of his. But instead, he saw the importance of the plan, and he decided that he would muster all of his political currency to work hand-in-hand with Marshall to help the plan pass Congress. So it's really this extraordinary group of people who were behind the genesis and the execution of the plan. And then later on, Hoffman brought on an extraordinary array of very capable people to help him execute the program.
Hmm. Do you have some idea where that sense of duty came from for these individuals?
It's a great question. I'm often asked that. And, you know, I think we're very lucky to have the group of people we did occupy those seats of power at that time. And, you know, it's sort of like asking, you know, why were the founding fathers so extraordinary? And I think part of it is simply fortuitous. We were lucky to have great men back then. But I think that part of it also had to be the culture and the ethos of the time. We had come out of World War II, where there was a spirit of sacrifice and service, and everything sort of hung in the balance. And even if before then, there had been the Great Depression, in which service and sacrifice were essential. And so there was this time, and I think that spirit very much infuses that post-war moment, helping to attract extraordinary people and helping to shape those people. I think the war was probably the crucible upon which their character and their perspective was forged. And so I think, you know, if we're to translate that into the contemporary moment, I suppose that the hope is that the profound things that have happened in terms of 9/11 and the two wars that we've been involved with, and really some of the mistakes that we've made. In World War II, we did so many things right, but I think in these last years we've made some critical mistakes. My hope is that this period, perhaps the mistakes that we've made and the changes, the challenges we've been presented with, can be the crucible upon which a new generation, a new cadre of leaders are formed. And it's in sort of redemption. It's in getting things right and in building a new world to meet these threats and challenges that I hope, from which I hope our new class of leaders emerge.
The Marshall Plan is our topic this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest is foreign policy scholar Greg Berman. He is the author most recently of The Most Noble Adventure, The Marshall Plan and the Time When America Helped Save Europe. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with a telephone call this afternoon, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's take another call now. A listener on a cell phone, line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
Oh, now I can't hear you.
Well, I can hear
you. There
you
are. There you are. Okay. Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to touch base. I always love to hear this topic discussed, the Marshall Plan. I have a family connection with this. My grandfather, his name was Pat Frain. I don't know if he's related at all to your WILL staff member there. Was in the public relations office in Paris and then Athens, working with the Marshall Plan. So it's part of our family history, family lore. You mentioned about how we can learn from the mistakes, and I don't know to what extent you've covered this already, or you covered in your book about how the Marshall Plan just seems to me learning from the mistake of Versailles.
Yeah, it's a great point. This was, Harry Truman liked to say that it's a measure of American greatness at that moment that in fact we had done something that no other country had done. You know, in the past, the approach had always been to, if there was a defeated power, to seek reparations or to keep that wartime enemy down. And instead, America was now about to build up the countries which it had just been at war at, which had been behind World War II and the conflagration that had spurred up during that time, and so it was in learning that that after World War I there had been a very punitive peace against Germany, and that had created conditions which helped to give rise to Hitler and Nazism, and the totalitarianism of the 30s, and that they did not want to repeat that mistake. They wanted, instead of separating or keeping down Germany and the other powers, they wanted to build them up and bring them in and co-opt them as partners and integrate them into their economic and political systems. And it was obviously a very wise approach. It helped to create the basis and the foundation of the post-war political order, and for Europe, a period of peace and prosperity that few people would have dreamed of during those very difficult post-war years.
Right, and I appreciate also that, you know, there was something in it for the United States to build up our major allies, trading partners, and military allies as well. I also appreciate your comment earlier about how it's difficult to overlay a program from the past on current conditions. I think that's a very wise warning. But nonetheless, there are similar things perhaps we can do with our foreign policy that would get us along those lines.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you mentioning that, and it's great to hear from someone whose legacy is whose legacy in this time in history. And sometime I'd love to hear more of your stories.
whenever I get to Paris, I get to go to the Place de Concorde, and his office was right there on the corner. So
yeah,
it's always a fun part for us.
Well, that's fantastic. It's definitely a proud legacy, and you share in it very directly. But we all really share in it. We're the beneficiaries of the decisions that those great statesmen made, and that people like your grandfather?
Be my grandfather. Right?
That your grandfather, they worked in very difficult conditions, and did something very successful, and we continue to benefit from it.
Well, thanks again.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. I've got another caller who's waiting to talk with us. I'm going to get to that call pretty quickly here, but I do want to, before too much time goes on, I do want to ask you a big question. How did the Marshall Plan affect the Cold War?
Well, it's a great question. It was very much rooted in the geopolitics of the time and what was going on with U.S.-Soviet relations. And it was becoming clear to Marshall that it would not be possible to achieve a post-war accommodation with Stalin and the Soviet Union, that, in fact, they did have expansionist designs in Europe and were purposely profiting strategically from Western Europe's deterioration, its economic deterioration, and the rise of national communist parties, even in countries like France and Italy. And so Marshall realized that it was getting worse and worse, and that America could, that America and the West and the world could lose the continent to communism. And so he realized that America had to retake control of the initiative, and there sort of became this battle on the theater of time that America had to move forward with something bold, and of course it risked a confrontation with the Soviet Union. When the Marshall Plan was launched, the Soviets realized immediately how harmful it could be to their own designs, because it was perhaps the most effective way of bringing Western Europe into the American orbit. And they tried very hard to launch an ambitious propaganda program to prevent it from working, tried to get their communist allies in Western Europe to sabotage it. And what it did do is it helped to pull, the Soviets pulled the Eastern Europe out from participation, and it really did help to trigger the Cold War. This program, which we rightly think of as humanitarian and altruistic, was very much rooted in the Cold War and the U.S.-Soviet rivalry, and did help to calcify what was already an emerging division between the Eastern and the Western blocs. But I think the day that the Soviet foreign minister pulled his delegation and ordered the Eastern European countries in the Soviet orbit not to participate is perhaps as good a day as any to mark as the beginning of the Cold War.
Let's take that call now. Listener in Champaign County on line two. Hi.
Hi. I guess I have the unenviable task of perhaps offering a heretical analysis of this. I'm thinking of Noam Chomsky's analysis of the post-war era. I don't know if you ever get any questions that actually question the you know, you've been acknowledging along that it was not just a altruistic kind of
right.
Enterprise. It was something that would have solidified the Pax Americanas, if you will. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't like to hear it that way, but I think that's reasonable. If I've heard one analysis of the Marshall Plan that if you look at it in a way, it was a way of subsidizing the French project of the colonization of Indochina, that they were very hard pressed to have the economic wherewithal to continue the project there, and that if you look at how much money was transferred, it's fairly comparable, and it looks like it was a way of subsidizing that project in the early days of the war. There are other things too. The idea that we were using the Marshall Plan to break unions in France and Italy. You have to look at the diplomatic history that was going on at the same time. There were things happening like the Gladio project, which was a way of intervening in Italian economy and subsidizing the parties that we were picking as winners. Now, this is always reduced to just the idea of communism, but there were rather indigenous leftists. In fact, these were the people that actually won the war to a large extent.
Right.
So what I'm getting at is that I think it's a rather commonplace way of looking at it that you're offering. I don't want to say anything snide about about your chair at being named for Henry Kissinger, but
right.
You know, that's the kind of realpolitik that we we're used to, and I just think that people need to look a little deeper into this whole post-war phenomena.
Yeah. Well, thanks, caller. I appreciate your call. You know, I've spent 3 years of intensive research looking at it, so I tried to look at it pretty deeply. I'm very aware of the Chomsky analysis and the Kolko analysis and others, what people would call the revisionist school. And France was engaged in Indochina, for example, and it's very possible that Marshall dollars and American support helped to prolong their engagement. But that was not our motivation. I think you can probably take anything in which any of the European powers were involved in at the time and say that, you know, Marshall Plan dollars or American aid indirectly or tacitly helped abet those sort of activities. That was not the focus. We were, in fact, anti-colonialist insofar as we were pushing Europe. Our focus was to help Europe recover. And it was self-interested, but it was an enlightened form of self-interest. Our view was that we would benefit if Europeans benefited and prospered and were stable. And the proof, as they say, is in the pudding. Europe moved forward with the most prolonged economic boom in European history. It was a time of modernization, industrialization, shared prosperity, an extraordinary amount of peace and cooperation. This laid the basis for the European integration and the European Union, which was one of the great, extraordinary achievements of the 20th century, of world history, really. And so I think if you look at what the Marshall Plan helped to launch, Europeans benefited more than anyone. And the post-war European experience has been, by any metric, given Europe's history, the history of war and economic problems has been extraordinary, and so I think we can. There are criticisms, and it's good that there are, but I think that an objective assessment of our motivations and the results suggests that this really was an extraordinary achievement, shared achievement by Americans and Europeans, and it is something that we can be very proud of.
I don't know if the caller's still there. You want a quick follow-up?
Oh, yeah. Well, I disagree. I think that a light and self-interest is one thing to call it, but the kind of things that the CIA was doing under the cover of all this are need to be examined as well. They're really reprehensible. We were cashing arms around all of Europe. I mean, for what we saw as the fight for Europe, I guess. But it was mainly a cover for, it seems to me, the stabilization of Pax Americanus and tying the Europe to our economy in ways that they're only now, I think, developing independence from. We were breaking unions using mafiosa thugs in the south of France, partially related to Marshall spending. So I wanted to, people can Google Chomsky in post-World War II and probably find a heretical treatment of that. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Were there many unattractive, unintended consequences? And the caller mentioned the CIA. Maybe you'd want to talk about that.
Well, the CIA was, the caller's right to say that the CIA was involved in Europe in these years, that the Marshall Plan actually, they actually got some of the first funding for covert CIA operations from Marshall dollars. Their activities were relatively, were not absolutely rampant. They were mostly focused on breaking communist unions. One of the things that I believe is historically incorrect is that, in fact, there were labor leaders who American labor leaders who worked on the Marshall Plan with the other caller's grandfather in Paris. Labor leaders were senior portion of the Marshall Plan. American labor was very much for the Marshall Plan. Labor was, in fact, very much against communists and the communist infiltration of American labor, and America helped to build up Europe's non-communist labor unions and capacity. It's true that we did help to break communist labor movement, but at the same time, the caller didn't mention that these unions were busy sabotaging Europe's economy, were blowing up railroad train tracks. So that supplies could not travel. The workers at the dock were not taking on shipments from ports. They wanted to strangle Europe's economy at a time in which there was mass hunger, poverty, difficulties, so that communists could reap the benefit and come to power. And we've seen, if you want to do an analysis of what the communist future would have been like, you just simply need to look at Eastern Europe and that experience, and measure it against Western Europe. Western Europe thrived economically, politically, culturally through the post-war years, and of course, the Eastern Europe experience was one of oppression and economic degradation. And one of the interesting metrics that comes out of this, the Cold War, is that America spent in dollars roughly the same amount with the Marshall Plan and other aid that the Soviet Union actually took out of Eastern Europe in reparations and in capital extraction. So this wasn't perfect, and it was self-interested, and the CIA, for better or worse, was involved, and we interfered with European countries, and there were missteps made. All of these things are true and shouldn't be overlooked and are part of the story that I told in this book. But it should not cloud over or prevent us from seeing the larger good and the larger achievement, and what a foreign policy that is sound, that is wise, that is humble, that is informed by a spirit of cooperation and partnership, and the application of American power in all of its dimensions, applied judiciously, can achieve, because it really was a great achievement, and I think we can be proud of it.
There, we'll leave it. Greg Berman, thank you for talking with us this afternoon.
Great to be with you, Celeste.
Greg Berman is the author of The Most Noble Adventure, The Marshall Plan, and The Time When America Helped Save Europe. The publisher, The Free Press.